Well, we're going to finish up chapter 12 tonight of Revelation, verses 13 through 17. Let me read those. And when the dragon saw that he was thrown down to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. And the two wings of the great eagle were given to the woman in order that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she was nourished for a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent. And the serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman, so that he might cause her to be swept away with the flood. And the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and drank up the river which the dragon poured out of his mouth. And the dragon was enraged with the woman and went off to make war with the rest of her offspring who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. Well, as we have mentioned before, all ideas, all beliefs have consequences. You know, all effects have causes. If our vehicle breaks down, we know it didn't just happen all by itself. There's a cause for it. So all effects have causes. And so when we look around and we see the condition of our world today, and our nation in the world, and we just see all the commotion, all the chaos, all the instability, all the strife, all the division, all the ungodliness, all the immorality, and to where just immorality and ungodliness has become mainstream and the norm. And then we look at the condition of the professing church, and we see so much inundation of false teaching, false worship, false practices, false gospels. And we have to ask ourselves, where is this coming from? What's the ultimate cause of this? What we're seeing is the effects, but what are the causes of it? And of course, we can say a lot, much of it goes back to the rejection of God, the rejection of His Word, the rejection of His Son. It says over in Jeremiah chapter 18, verse 15, God tells Israel, for my people have forgotten me. And what's the effect of this forgetting him? They burn incense to worthless gods. They have stumbled from their ways, from the ancient paths, to walk and bypass not on a highway, to make their land a desolation, an object of perpetual hissing. And so, ultimately, it goes back to their rejection and their forgetting of God. And this is what we're seeing so much of today. There's this defining of Christianity in terms that are so broad and so vague and so ambiguous as to include virtually any conception of Jesus and any system of salvation. But again, we have to ask the question, why? Why has there been this exchanging of the truth of God for a lie? Is the cause of this an intellectual thing? Is it just we've become too smart for the Bible? Is it intellectual? Or is it spiritual? I mean, who's the father of lies? Satan, right? Who's the ruler of this world? 1 John 5:19. Satan. And so in Revelation 12, we're seeing the spiritual forces that are behind the events that are occurring on earth. We're seeing the cause of the effects. Remember what Paul said over in Ephesians 6:12 in his teaching concerning the full armor of God, where he says, "For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places." So right here, Paul tells us what our struggle first is not against. It's not against flesh and blood. But he also tells us what it is against. It's against the rulers, the powers, the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places, or more literally, it's against the spirituals of wickedness in the heavenlies. See, Satan and his angels are spirits. They're evil, wicked, fallen spirits. The nature of their work is spiritual. The sins to which they tempt and provoke are predominantly spiritual in nature. They may have temporal and physical manifestations, but the work and the temptations are principally spiritual. And as spirits, Satan and his minions are vastly more cunning, they are vastly more intelligent than us. You see, when Satan fell, his knowledge was corrupted, but it wasn't lost. When Satan fell, he lost his place. He didn't lose his power. He still has his power as an angelic being. And so, he uses all his knowledge and his cunning and his power. All of that has been turned to evil ends. And his spirits, Satan and his minions, they're invisible, right? They're invisible to human perception, as are all their workings. Today, especially within some many elements of the charismatic movement, you have people who think there's a devil behind every bush, you know, and they're always rebuking this devil or that devil. I've seen charismatic teachers advertising tape series on how to overcome the demon of debt or how to overcome a demon of smoking. And so everything is attributed to a demon. And so they're always looking out for these demons, but they remain completely unaware of the evil and sin that exists and that they carry around in their own hearts and minds that is the fodder and the tool that which Satan uses and works. See, the world is always wanting to attribute things and events to second causes. People want to deal, they look at symptoms and then they ignore the root cause, and they're always trying to fix symptoms, and as a result, in trying to fix the symptoms, the root cause goes untreated and ignored, and things just tend to get worse and worse. Also with spirits, Satan and his demons, they're immortal. Our enemy never dies. God may regulate their activity, and He governs their activity, and He uses it for His own plan and purpose, and He often will bind, but then Satan will come right back. The Bible tells us if we resist the devil, he will flee from us, and that is true, but he doesn't stay away. He comes right back. And so as spirits, they never grow tired, they never give up, they may retire for a while to lull us into a false sense of security, just like Satan did with Jesus. Not that he could lull Jesus into a false sense of security, but after his failed temptation of Jesus, it said that he departed from Jesus until a more opportune time. And this is what Satan will do. He may retire simply only to lull into a false security, simply to return in a more opportune time when we've relaxed our guard, when we've maybe taken off some of the armor of God. So we see the real foe of all Christians, and are the real foe of all believers, is Satan. And that believers, Christians, are the primary objects of Satan's hostility. We just think of Job. Satan comes to accuse Job. Job was the most righteous man on earth, so he was a prime target for the work of Satan. We think of David, who Satan incited to number Israel, all out of pride, so David could know how big his country was, and how many people he ruled over, and how big his army was. And this was all incited by Satan. Peter and the disciples, Satan demanded to sift them as wheat. And so the primary objects of his hostility is believers. They're the primary objects of his malice. And the sphere of Satan's activity is this world. It's not heaven. He may be in heaven accusing believers in heaven, but the sphere of his activity is this world. Satan was in heaven accusing Job, but all the activity of the satanic activity against Job took place in this world, not heaven. But see, the believer's riches are in heaven, right? Not in heaven, not on this earth. So there's nothing Satan can do to rob us of our eternal riches. Satan is the ruler over darkness. But Paul tells us in Ephesians, we're of light, not of darkness. We've been transferred from the domain of darkness to the kingdom of His beloved Son. And so here we can just see what the horrible condition is of all who walk in darkness, whom they are ruled by, this malicious tyrant that rules over them. This is why in Revelation 12 in verse 8, where we are told that there was no longer a place found for them in heaven, that is for the dragon and his angels, they are cast out of heaven because there's no longer a place for them. There's all this spiritual warfare, if you want to call it that, going on where Satan in the spiritual realm has attacked the very seat of God and as such is thrown out. Now this expulsion produced, as we saw in verse 12, rejoicing in heaven. But it produced woe to the earth and to the sea. Woe to the earth and the sea. Why? Because the devil has come down to you, having great wrath, knowing that he has only a short time. See, the devil is not omnipresent. Even though he's come down to the earth, he's going to have a specific target. He's not omnipresent. And he's coming down to earth having great wrath, great anger, great malice. The word denotes an intense, passionate outburst of anger. You see, Satan is already wicked and evil and malicious to the extreme. He is the father of lies. He is a murderer from the beginning. He is a destroyer. He is the evil one, Jesus calls him. But he's not only evil, he is maliciously evil. He's like a weasel in a chicken coop, which we've had experience with. You know, they're in there to kill just to kill. To wreak as much damage and havoc as they possibly can. So Satan is not only evil, he is maliciously evil. But he cannot strike at God, so he goes after what is precious to God, to what is His. And that is His people. Not that he can cause them to lose their salvation, but simply to destroy for the sake of destroying. To cause them maybe to dishonor God. To bring reproach on Him. But see, here, Satan's anger and malice and wrath that is already great is taken to a new heights. It's now aggravated by the knowledge that he has only a short time. 3.5 years to be precise. It corresponds with the reign of the beast that comes up out of the sea in chapter 13, verse 1. Now, verse 13 of Revelation 12 resumes where verse 6 left off. Verses 7 through 12 were showing us the scene that was taking place in heaven. And here, the scene shifts back to earth and is showing the spiritual realities that are behind what is going to be taking place on earth. And the first target of Satan's malice here is the woman. When the dragon saw that he was thrown down to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. And as we've seen In her other studies, the woman here is national Israel. It's not the church. The church didn't give birth to Jesus. This is national Israel. Jesus is the son of David. So it's national Israel. And he persecuted the woman. The word persecuted there means to put to flight, to pursue. Now some have tried to interpret this as saying that this is really referring back to the Old Testament, that this is Pharaoh, or it's the perennial enemies of Old Testament Israel. But to try to interpret it in that way just requires some massive allegorizing of the text. Rather, what is going on here corresponds to what Jesus said in his Olivet Discourse over in Matthew 24, verses 15 through 26. When Jesus states, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who is on the housetop not go down to get the things out that are in his house. Let him who is in the field not turn back to get his cloak. But woe to those who are with child and to those who nurse babes in those days. But pray that your flight may not be in the winter or on a Sabbath, for then there will be a great tribulation, such as has not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever shall. And unless those days have been cut short, no life would have been saved, but for the sake of the elect, those days shall be cut short." And so, this is the flight, this is the event that is taking place that Jesus described. So we see Satan here in a passionate, hostile, malicious pursuit of believing Israel, because Israel is the origin of the child. He couldn't kill the child. He couldn't kill the woman. Or he couldn't kill the child. He couldn't. And he's now going after the woman. Just a malicious attack. Well, we've seen this before, haven't we? Not to this extent. But we can surmise how Satan could do something like this. It wouldn't be hard for him to stir up anti-Semitism again, would it? Just like it did in the 1930s and 40s in Nazi Germany. To stir up in the minds of men this anti-Semitism again. Or some sort of religious persecution, or to make Israel the scapegoat for problems that are going on in the world. We've seen it before. And so, again, remember, Satan works spiritually. He works through the minds of men and their lusts and their desires. And so, for him to stir up this persecution in the hearts of men is not hard to imagine. And again, Satan's rage at this time is directed at believing Israel. Not the earth as a whole. He's come down to the earth as a whole. But his wrath, his malice, is focused, it's concentrated on believing Israel. They get his undivided attention. The woe that's pronounced in verse 12 to the earth and to the sea is because Satan has come down. But the object of his wrath is going to be believing Israel. The entire earth will suffer as a result of that. The entire earth will get drug into that as a result of his attempt to persecute Israel and satisfy his bloodlust for the woman. But his primary attention is the woman. The woman who gave birth to the male child, to Jesus Christ. Now verse 14 tells us how the woman escapes. "And the two wings of the great eagle were given to the woman in order that she might fly into the wilderness to her place where she was nourished for a time and times and half a time from the presence of the serpent." This is essentially what was said up in verse 6, that the woman fled into the wilderness where she had a place prepared by God, so that there she might be nourished for 1,260 days. That pretty much defines the time, times, and half time. It's 3.5 years. And so, this is all, she is protected by an act of God's miraculous divine intervention. See, this is a wonderful comfort for believers, because Satan, even when his malice and rage are compounded, he's no match for God's hand of protection over his own. Apostle John tells us in 1 John 5:18 that the evil one has no power over us. But we're told here in Revelation that the woman was given the two wings of the great eagle. And this is a reference to, and often the same terminology used of Israel's deliverance from Egypt over in Exodus 19:4. Where God tells Israel, "You yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself." Also over in Deuteronomy 32:11, much of the same type of imagery. "Like an eagle that stirs up its nest, that hovers over its young, he spread his wings and caught them and carried them in his pinions." And so there's this idea of shelter, of refuge, of strength, and of speed and protection that God has provided and given to the woman. And the purpose he's given it to her is in order that she might fly into the wilderness to her place. It's her place. It's a place that was given or for her. It's these wings, this ability to flee, being carried out, was for the purpose of flying to a place prepared in the wilderness. Just as the flight from Egypt was a literal flight, so this is going to be a literal flight of these believing Jews. Remember what Jesus said that we read just over there in Matthew 24. Flee to the mountains. The mountains around Jerusalem, that is. Now, many people have tried to speculate that this is Petra, an area of an ancient city area, a lot of caves and red sandstone cliffs with a lot of caves in them. In fact, you've even had some very messianic type groups go around and start putting New Testaments and Bibles in the caves all in Petra, so that when the Jews flee there, they'll have their Bibles there in these caves. And as though it's some sort of evangelistic attempt, but these are going to be believing Jews who are believing Israel who are fleeing there. But this is a place that's prepared by God. It's a place prepared for her. It's her place. That is, it's specifically prepared for her, where she's nourished. See, God prepares a place for His people. And she's nourished there. Present tense. Continuously. For these 3.5 years. We can think back of like Elijah in the wilderness, who God sent ravens to feed him. We can think of God providing Israel with manna in the wilderness, even with and water, and with even quail. God always provides for His own, miraculously and providentially. There are so many instances in the Bible of this. We can just look at a couple of examples, though. If you remember over in 1 Kings 17:9, where in reference to Elijah, God tells Elijah to go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and stay there. "Behold, I have commanded a widow there to provide for you." And the same thing in 1 Kings 18, verse 4, that when Jezebel is pursuing all the prophets of God, says that Obadiah took 100 prophets and hid them by 50s in a cave and provided them with bread and water. So God always, miraculously or providentially, always does, keeps and provides for His own. Well, we can even think back to even when God was judging Egypt through all the plagues. There were all these horrendous plagues coming upon Egypt, but they weren't happening over in the land of Goshen. God was protecting them. Now this is going to be extremely important for believing Israel at this particular time, because remember, during this time, this 3.5 years, this beast out of the sea is going to cause people to have a mark where they won't be able to buy or sell anything without the mark of the beast. Something that believers won't be able to do or be involved with. And so God will have to miraculously and providentially provide for them. And it's for 3.5 years, the last half of the tribulation. And they're going to be, notice at the end of verse 14, that this her place in the wilderness, the place where she's going to be nourished, is from the presence of the serpent. Going to be free from the presence of the serpent. His malice, his evil, his persecutions, his pursuits. It's going to be preserved from Satan's persecutions. As well, because notice here in verses 13 through 17, the word dragon and serpent is used somewhat interchangeably. And we've seen that oftentimes when Satan is referred to as a dragon, it's referring to his persecution as a serpent, it's to his deceptiveness. And so here, Israel is not only going to be preserved or kept from the presence of Satan's persecutions as a dragon, but also from the presence of the serpent and his deceptions. Because remember what Jesus said over in Matthew 24, again, Matthew 24, 23 and 24. Then if anyone says to you, behold, here is the Christ, or there he is, do not believe him. For false Christs and false prophets will arise and will show great signs and wonders, so as to mislead, if possible, even the elect. Behold, I have told you in advance. If therefore they say to you, behold, he's in the wilderness, do not go forth. Or behold, he's in a room, do not believe them. So they would be preserved and protected from the persecutions and from the deceptions. See, this is always Satan's double-barreled attack. Sometimes he uses one, sometimes he uses the other, but when his malice is extremely aggravated, he uses both. Because he is having great wrath. And as such, believing Israel at this time will be isolated from the rest of society. So they're going to be nourished physically, they're going to be nourished spiritually. All their needs will be provided for. You see, the woman in and of herself is no match for the dragon. No match for the serpent on her own. No more than we are. Not a chance. Now sometimes God will leave His children to be ravaged, so they flee to Him to show us our impotency, our helplessness, our hopelessness. If you remember, Jesus told Peter that Satan had demanded permission to sift you, that is all you, all the disciples, like wheat. And we saw it happen to him, didn't it? And Peter never denied Jesus again. Never. And also, God allows Satan to sift us, just so that we learn to set a more secure watch and guard over our own heart and mind, to see our absolute need and dependence on grace and a distrust of ourself. But here, Satan, he will corrupt God's truth a direct attack against God. He'll infect the church with error. He'll infect with errors in judgment, with unholy lives. You see, error is not so innocent as many want to make it out to be. It can infest. Little leaven leavens the whole lump. And once the leaven gets in, you don't get it out again. And so, these believers are going to be protected from all that. And this attempt to persecute and to deceive is thwarted by God. So Satan tries a different way. Remember, we say Satan, he don't give up. So verse 15, so the serpent poured water like a river out of his mouth after the woman, so that he might cause her to be swept away with the flood. That word poured literally, it's in the Greek, the word literally is he threw water like a river. He didn't say it was a river, but it's like a river. And the purpose was so that they would be caused to be swept away like with a flood. In this imagery is drawn from Daniel chapter 9, verse 26 and 27. And this is the prophecy of the 62 or the 70 weeks. Then after the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off, have nothing, and the people, the prince who is to come, will destroy the city and the sanctuary, and its end will come with a flood. Even to the end there will be war, desolations are determined, and he will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week. So the desolation here will come with a flood. Also over in Daniel chapter 11, verse 21 through 23, speaking of this despicable person, in his place a despicable person will arise, on whom the honor of kingship has not been conferred, but he will come in a time of tranquility and seize the kingdom by intrigue, and the overflowing forces will be flooded away before him and shattered, and also the prince of the covenant. And then verse 32, and by smooth words he will turn to godliness those who act wickedly toward the covenant. But the people who know their God will display strength and take action. So it's these smooth words, this flood of hypocrisy, or flood of apostasy that's coming in, that is attempts to sweep them away. Now it's impossible to be dogmatic here. It's exactly what this flood is. We know it's being used metaphorically, but it's some sort of force by an authority figure. See this over in chapter 13, verse 6. He opened his mouth in blasphemies against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, that is, those who dwell in heaven. And so there's just this flood, this tide of apostasy that most in the world at this time are just going to be swept up in by and swept by. And remember, Jesus even said that unless this time had been cut short, not even the elect would have been saved. So there's just this tide of apostasy that most people will be swept up in. And again, this is not too hard to imagine, is it, given the condition of our day today? And so in a time of persecution, in a time of hardship and trial, people are more vulnerable to attacks by Satan. Now you read histories of the great persecutions of that occurred in the church, and how people will sell out, even family members, sell out friends in order to preserve their own lives and keep their own selves from being persecuted. And so to avoid suffering, people will compromise with error. They'll go ahead and get the mark on them. I mean, people will even come to where they attribute their suffering to their obedience. Remember over in Jeremiah 44, when Jeremiah is telling the people to be obedient to God, don't go to Egypt, stay here, be faithful to God, and the people keep saying, we're not going to listen to you. And besides, ever since we quit sacrificing to the Queen of Heaven, our lives have been terrible. When we were sacrificing to the Queen of Heaven, then everything was great. But as soon as we quit, everything went bad. So people will even come to attribute their suffering to their obedience. That's how bad the deception can get. They're going to be protected from this. Satan will attempt to sweep away with a flood of evil, to inundate them, to overwhelm them with this evil, with false teaching, false doctrines. But God will protect them from all of this. And we see in verse 16, and the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened its mouth and drank up the river which the dragon poured out of his mouth. Just the term help there, really, it literally means to come to the aid of, to give, to supply what is needed. So the earth helped the woman. The earth supplied what the woman needs. And the earth opened its mouth and drank up the river. Obviously, this is, again, being used metaphorically, because the earth doesn't have a mouth. But the mouth, the earth opened up, it drank up, it swallowed up. It can literally means to destroy or to bring to an end. So the earth supplied what was needed to destroy or swallow up this flood of evil which Satan is pouring out in his attempt to sweep the woman away. We're told that here, if this occurs in the place where she was nourished. Again, perhaps this place where they are, it's just too isolated. It's too isolated for all this evil, all this deception to get there. And because it's the earth that is helping the woman, it's some sort of providential, secondary cause, some instrument used of God to destroy or bring an end to this flood of evil. It's not God intervening directly, miraculously, but it's God using means, some providential secondary cause or instrument to bring to an end this flood of evil before it can reach those being nourished by God. All right, we see this so often, that God will often prevent the perpetration of evil that is intended by others against God's own. And he does this by neutralizing the power. Remember, over in Exodus, when Pharaoh was trying to destroy the Israelites, and Pharaoh tells all the midwives to throw all the male children into the Nile. Midwives don't do it. They thwarted Pharaoh's plan and perpetration and intention of evil. God used him in that way. Well, this further enrages the dragon, verse 17, and the dragon was enraged with the woman. And so he redirects his rage to another target. He can't get the child. He can't get the woman who gave birth to the child. So he went off to make war with the rest of her offspring, who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. See, this is Satan's MO. If he can't get at his target directly, then he goes at it indirectly. If he can't come in the front, he'll try to find some open window. He'll try to slip in the back. If he finds one way blocked and guarded, then he tries to find a way that's unguarded. Remember, Satan couldn't get at Jesus directly. So where does he come in his next temptation? Through Peter. To where Jesus has to say, "Get behind me, Satan." Jesus saw through. He knew where it was coming from. So he had already had to redirect his attacks from the son to the woman. Now he has to redirect his attacks from the woman to the rest of her offspring. There's this repeated frustration only increases Satan's anger and his hostility and his hatred. He never gives up. He never gives up. He's always on the lookout for an opportunity. Well, who is this third group? This rest of her offspring. Well, we're given a definition of them. They keep, that is, they watch over, they guard the commandments of God. And hold, that is, grasp, they're having, holding and having the testimony of Jesus. Both of those verbs, keep and hold, are in the present tense. They're constantly keeping, guarding the commandments of God from corruption and perversion. Remember what Paul told Timothy? Oh, Timothy, guard what has been entrusted to you. Avoiding the arguments falsely called knowledge. Guard the treasure that's entrusted to you. This is what they are doing. They are keeping, guarding the commandments of God. And they are holding, that is, holding fast, grasping, not letting it go, the testimony of Jesus. Well, obviously this is not those in the wilderness, those who are being sheltered by God. There's many opinions to the identity of this group, but whatever identity we give them, it has to conform to their description. And of all the various attempts to try to identify this group, and we could name several, but just for the sake of time, it's best to identify them primarily, or best to identify them as the 144,000 that were sealed to be witnesses and testimonies to the gospel of Jesus Christ during this time. They are an active worldwide witness and preachers during the tribulation. Even the tribulation of chapter 13, if you remember over in chapter 11, there were two agents, the two witnesses, who were also prophesying during this time. And they also met their end at the hands of the beast. Verse 7 of chapter 11, when they had finished their testimony, the beast that comes up out of the abyss will make war with them and overcome them and kill them. And so, here we have these 144,000. Then when you turn over to chapter 14, verses 1 through 5, chapter 14 is proleptic. That is, it's looking ahead. And here we see the 144,000 singing a new song before the throne, before they're in heaven now. And so, here Satan, during this last half of the tribulation, diverts his attention now to these 144,000. They're keeping the commandments of God is the exact opposite of the value system under which the beast and under which the dragon and the beast and the false prophet are operating right now. They are anti-Christ, where the 144,000 hold to the testimony of Christ. Remember in 1 John, the Apostle John wrote that the spirit of Antichrist is abroad in the world even today. I mean, we see it today. I mean, name an institution in this country that is not run by Antichrist. You know, our government is Antichrist, anti-God's law. Most of our institutions of higher learning are Antichrist. Business is anti-Christ. There's so much, the so-called science is anti-Christ, much of it. So the spirit of Antichrist is abroad in the world. the multitude of errors that we see within the church are anti-Christ. And so many today are being swept up in them. But it's Satan's attack that gets turned during the last half of the tribulation on this group. They keep the commandments of God. They hold, they guard, they protect. And they are holding that to the testimony of Jesus. Now the first part, depending on what translation you have, verse 17 includes what some translation place at the beginning of chapter 13, and he stood on the sand of the seashore. That's where chapter 12 ends. He stood on the sand of the seashore. The dragon is preparing to give his power and dominion to two beasts, one out of the sea and one out of the earth. And that's what we'll see next time, is who these are. These world leaders that will come out that will be satanically empowered during this second half of the tribulation. So again, here we're seeing in chapter 12 the spiritual realities behind all world events, especially as they relate to the people of God, who are the object of Satan's most intense assaults. He can't unsave us, but he can seek to destroy our testimony, stifle the work of God in the world. And the only chance of withstanding him and standing firm is what Paul prescribes in Ephesians 6, to put on the full armor of God. God can overcome all his enemies without our help, but we can't even begin to resist and defend ourselves without his armory. We have to be supplied. We have to be enabled. We have to be made willing. We have to be sustained and strengthened by the hand of God. And it's all dependent upon his grace and the strength of his might. The spiritual enemy, spiritual battles require spiritual power and spiritual weapons. And if we take them off for a moment, we're exposed. And Satan will not miss an opportunity. And so here in chapter 12, we're seeing the spiritual realities behind what's going to be taking place on earth, particularly in relation to the people of God, that will be working itself out during the last half of the tribulation.